loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. First, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has declared that North Korea is begging for war in the aftermath of its most recent nuclear test. Next, we talk about the Trump administration's decision to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Then we go to Houston, Texas. On a visit to Houston over the weekend, Donald Trump said the Hurricane Harvey relief operation was working out well, but the scale of devastation is immense. Next, we talk about the Syrian government forces who have breached a three-year siege of the strategic city of Deir al-Zor. Is the war with ISIS almost ended? And finally, while the U.S. mulls sending lethal weapons to Ukraine's government, Russia is proposing a peacekeeping operation in the eastern part of the country to defuse simmering tensions. But first, we turn to North Korea, its most recent nuclear weapons test, and U.S.-North Korean relations. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Hans Christensen. He is the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. And we're joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Welcome, Hans and Greg.
Hello. Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is a big issue, of course. World is sort of watching the Korean Peninsula right now. The outcome could be very grave. We want to be able to spend some time talking about the scientific, technological, and political issues. But before we do, I want to play a short audio clip. This is Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, speaking at the UN yesterday. Let's listen to her, and then we'll start.
Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. He wants to be acknowledged as a nuclear power. But being a nuclear power is not about using those terrible weapons to threaten others. Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
Okay, I'm not so sure about that, Hans, that North Korea is begging for war. They might have a different agenda given how serious such a war would be. But let's talk about what North Korea has done, what they have achieved technologically with the latest nuclear test. Go ahead.
Well, the most significant development, of course, is the size of the explosion, which still has to be, you know, pinned down exactly. But the ranges I hear are sort of from 100 to 150 kiloton, depending on who you ask. And that's a significant increase from the 10 to 20 kiloton they had in the previous test. And then, of course, they have displayed what they say is a thermonuclear weapon, a two-stage thermonuclear weapon, which would be a significant technological step up the nuclear technology ladder if they had managed to do that. Normally, nuclear weapon states have in the past required a bit more nuclear testing to get to such a level. And so it is a surprise, of course, if it is such a weapon. I just want to say here that the yield in and of itself, of course, doesn't prove that it is a two-state thermonuclear weapon. You can also get that kind of a yield with a pure fission, so a single-stage fission weapon where you just pile a lot of uranium in. So, but it's a significant development. And certainly also, if seen in contact with the considerable progress they have demonstrated on ballistic missiles over the last, you know, several years, but especially under the current leader.
Okay, Greg Mello, the DPRK was in nuclear talks with the Bush administration, and before that, with the Clinton administration. They had suspended their program in the late 1990s, and then in the early term of George W. Bush, they announced they were leaving the NPT, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They began building nuclear weapons in earnest. Then there were talks at the end of the Bush administration. Those kind of collapsed. During the complete term of Obama, the two terms, the 8 years, Obama adopted something called strategic patience, meaning They were sort of treating North Korea's missile tests or nuclear weapons tests as a bargaining chip. In other words, to arouse alarm and fear from the West, and then the West would start to have negotiations with them. And Obama said, well, we're not going to play that game. We're just going to sit here and wait. They called it strategic patience. But in the meantime, the DPRK has made very, very, very significant advances in its technological capability.
Yes. And I think that it is well past time to start talking with the DPRK. It's more or less the opposite approach that Nikki Haley and President Trump have said. There's no other choice. They are a nuclear weapon state. They have a nuclear deterrent. It may or may not be, I think it's unlikely that it's can be sent to the continental United States, but that really doesn't matter. It will be soon in any case. It is possible to entertain doubts that they have a thermonuclear weapon, but there's no real strong reason to doubt that, I would say. I mean, a prudent person wouldn't doubt it if you're going to make decisions about being in a nuclear war with someone. Steve Bannon was right. Tens of millions of people would die in a war. The world would lose. And North Korea has won. If there was some kind of game where they were aiming to have a deterrent, well, they have one. And the United States has to talk to them in a serious way without preconditions. And the sanctions are not going to be helpful. I don't think we should be putting the screws on the population, because I don't think it will affect their weapons programs.
Hans Christensen, what's your attitude towards this? I mean, the sanctions, obviously the North Korean government has had very significant sanctions imposed on it. Russia's not happy. China's not happy with their nuclear program. On the other hand, both China and Russia are arguing that sanctions alone, even though they're going along with them, aren't going to do the trick. But what's your view?
Well, many things have been tried, and it's just that right now there seems to be sort of almost a competition to be the toughest, both in terms of language and operations, and that's clearly not helpful. And it is almost as if what's missing is a capacity, if you will, in the diplomatic corps and the political willingness to try new things. And I think that's what's necessary. You cannot just continue to turn on the existing heat as it's been before, because it's just like, it's like saying, you know, it didn't work before, so we'll try it again. And so they have to come up with a new game plan, and it has to be a sustained one, and it has to be an international one. But it does involve talking to the North Koreans directly. You can't scare them into submission. That has clearly been proven wrong. As for Haley's statement that, you know, that their posturing is not defensive, that nuclear deterrence is not about threatening, well, that certainly depends on where you're sitting. Because, you know, in the case of North Koreans, they've been very adamant about the fact that theirs is definitely motivated because they see a significant threat against them from the United States and South Korea. And this is not about who started and all these things, but it's just to say that once you have nuclear weapons, you have them because you threaten their potential use. We have a deterrent directed against North Korea as well that is definitely intended to threaten potential use of nuclear weapons as well. So once you have nukes, you play this game, and that's the requirement that we're facing now. Like Greg said, North Korea is a nuclear weapon state. We have to figure out how to relate and interact and deal with that from now on.
Let me ask you a technical question before we go back to Greg Mello, Hans. David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, told the New York Times he was, quote, skeptical that this design has been miniaturized to fit reliably on a ballistic missile. Just help the audience understand, what is miniaturization? Why is it important? And does the DPRK have it?
Well, nobody really knows, of course. And we're into deep intelligence, of course, when it comes to specifics about this, but they're working on it. And what they did set off was quite evidently something significantly more powerful than what they've had in the past. So they've either made some real progress in that in terms of scaling up a pure fission weapon or by making this leap into a two-stage thermonuclear weapon. Whether it is one or the other, I think really doesn't matter. It's interesting technologically to talk about, but of course, you know, 150 kilotons, whether it's detonated by a pure fission weapon over a city or it is from a thermonuclear web, doesn't really matter. You know, it's the same destruction. Whether they can miniaturize that technology or how it looks is sort of the big question in terms of long-range ballistic missiles. We don't know if what was set off underground was an operational type of warhead or if it was an experimental testing device that still needs to be downgraded or downscaled. But again, the North Koreans are saying they say they have it, and if they don't already have it, that they're certainly trying to work their way toward that capability.
Greg Mello, it seems to me that the U.S. government, the U.S. policymakers have made a lot of mistakes over the years. Of course, when your country is so big and so powerful, so dominant militarily, you can make a lot of mistakes and people aren't necessarily held to account for them. But some of them are miscalculations. I mean, when you think back about what Iraq was, the Bush and Cheney thought and Rumsfeld said, oh, that'll be fast because Iraq was weak and America strong. And then here we are, you know, in 2017 and U.S. forces are still fighting in Iraq. When you think about Korea, the possibility of a miscalculation seems to me to be very strong. And the media, like when I read the Washington Post, I'm always shocked by what seems to me to be a profound ignorance by the editorial writers. I mean, just to be editorial myself, because they actually think North Korea can be sort of forced into the corner and somehow will be trembling and you know, drop its nuclear weapons program. The North Koreans are pretty sophisticated. They're not like a bunch of peasants who don't know anything. They keep surprising the world with their capability. Just talk about that and the danger of miscalculation here.
Yes, well, it's huge for the reasons that you state. And it's also typical for an empire in this stage of their history to overestimate what they can do and how compliant people will be. I think that there's kind of a dangerous dynamic in Washington underway, not just with respect to North Korea, but in other ways too, and it's amplified by the media that somehow is used to visions of U.S. omnipotence, and I think that our decision makers can find themselves in a very loud echo chamber with a lot of peer pressure and having to respond to headlines which are really uninformed and unhelpful. And, you know, nobody wants to be the person who in U.S. post-World War World War II history, no senior leader wants to be painted as weak. And so this dynamic could easily run. Well, it has run out of control, I think. I think it's very dangerous.
Yeah, Hans Christensen, you make your organization, the Federation of American Scientists, you're looking at nuclear weapons. Now the Trump administration is talking about a new generation of nuclear weapons that we have to make them great again. He's also tweeting this morning, I'm allowing Japan and South Korea to buy substantially increased amount of highly sophisticated military equipment from the United States. I mean, it just seems to me, given that the stakes are so high, that there must be a different path. Go ahead.
Well, we've been trying to deter North Korea since the 1950s. So deterring North Korea is not a new thing. And the various administrations over all these years have piled on capabilities, of course, in trying to make that deterrent credible or fine-tune it to circumstances or whatever. In a way, now, unfortunately, we now hear sort of the notion here that it is not possible to deter North Korea, and therefore we have to move beyond certainly, you know, just deterring, but certainly certainly diplomatic options. You know, there have been some tweets saying, you know, there is only one thing they understand, and I think that is just an enormously uninformed take on what is required right now. So you see a lot of shopping going around town here in Washington right now, where I think people who are pushing a need for new nuclear weapons and different types of weapons, different ways of operating and deploying them, they're going Christmas shopping because the political situation is ripe, super ripe, for how to push these through. There's nothing better as, you know, important new developments in foreign threats, whether it be North Korea or Russia. But also when you have an administration that seems, you know, simplistic in its approach to how to deal with this and very gung-ho. So that is a very dangerous combination because what's missing from that, of course, is the well-thought-out strategic diplomatic approach to how to work this issue behind the scenes so you get results that you want in close collaboration with the allies in the region.
Yeah, lack of information and gung-ho, a toxic and dangerous combination. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Hans Christensen. He's the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. And we have been joined from Mexico, New Mexico, by Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Donald Trump administration has announced that it will end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, a program initiated by President Barack Obama. But with a six-month window before the program expires, the stage is set for intense political struggle, perhaps in the streets and perhaps in the U.S. Congress. We are joined from New York by Angie Kim, a community organizer with Min Kwan Center for Community Action, and she herself has received relief through the DACA program. Welcome back, Angie.
Thanks for having me, Brian, again.
Thank you. Let's, before we begin, listen to a short audio clip. It's Jeff Sessions, U.S. Attorney General, noted for his hostility to immigrants for years and years. Let's listen to what he says about DACA and why the Trump administration is ending it.
Occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch. The effect of this unilateral executive amnesty, among other things, contributed to a surge of minors at the southern border that yielded terrible humanitarian consequences. It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs.
Angie Kim, you know, the language of undocumented children brought here at a young age, the Attorney General, illegal aliens taking Americans' jobs. Your response?
Well, you know, it's been a tough day. You know, I've watched the press conference and you know, I know that Attorney General Sessions have a long-standing history of anti-immigrant sentiments and agendas. And, you know, once again, it's really heartbreaking to hear, you know, him portraying these hardworking immigrants who are already part of our society. And they're very much Americans, except on paper, to describe them as criminals and people who are taking jobs away from Americans. No, we are the jobs. We are, you know, the ones who drive the economy. We are the owners of small businesses. And I think a lot of his sentiments and his comments today, again, are based on, you know, his anti-immigrant agendas and belief and a way to just criminalize and create this false ideas about immigrants. And I think a lot of them are based and rooted in xenophobia against immigrants and frankly, racism.
Angie Kim is our guest. She's a community organizer in New York with the Min Kwan Center for Community Action. She herself came here as a young person. Your parents, Angie, as you described to us last week on this show, tried to change the status, in other words, to conform with legal requirements. That did not succeed. So you came here as a nine-year-old. Today you're 34. That means you've been here for more than a quarter of a century. And yet Jeff Sessions says you're an illegal alien, that you're taking American jobs, and that now with the end of DACA, unless Congress does something to fix it, you could be put on a priority list for deportation. Where would you be deported? I mean, you've only lived here since you were 9 years old. Today you're 34.
Exactly. America is home to us immigrants. This is where we build our lives and build families. There is no other home to go back to, or where we, often we hear where you belong. So a lot of these rhetorics are, deeply rooted in lack of understanding of the history of immigration, and frankly, it's a very natural phenomenon. It's complete false.
You know, the United States was always known as the land of immigrants. We have the Statue of Liberty with the inscription at the port, at the harbor in New York, where so many European immigrants came. Give us your tired, your huddled, your masses yearning to breathe free. But now we have immigrants who are coming from East Asia, maybe from Korea, maybe from other parts of Asia, people coming from Africa, people coming from Latin America, and suddenly, illegal alien is the new language for these immigrants, not the people who became sort of the cloth work, the tapestry that made America, quote, great. When you think about it, and when you're here and experiencing all of this, what's going on inside the immigrant community? Is there a lot of fear now? Is there a feeling that maybe Congress will take action? I mean, just give us a sense of how it feels.
It's a lot of different emotions happening all at once, and I think that's one of the overwhelming aspects of today. Obviously, today is a tough day for a lot of immigrants, including the undocumented young adults, as well as the rest of the 11 million, members, because, it's the family, too, that are also impacted by this, termination of program. But I'm very surprised to see the sheer amount of support that are coming, that are just pouring in. I mean, even today, constantly throughout the day, from the morning, I'm getting texts, emails, phone calls, kind words of support. We are affirming that we are a community. We're going to stand together. We're going to fight this back together. And today just been, a day of an emotional roller coaster. I mean, the news was very devastating, but also at the same time, the support that's coming through is also, it's just been tremendous. So, there is a lot of hope right now.
Right now, outside of where we are, we're in downtown Washington. We're on K Street. Just two blocks away is the White House. Thousands of people have been in the streets here and all over the country. I saw big high school student walkouts in Denver, Colorado. I'm sure there are many, many more. We have only 3 minutes left, Angie Kim. Ahead of Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Sessions' announcement, Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "Congress, get ready to do your job, DACA, ! Now Congress has a six-month window to save DACA. Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republican Party, who is so hostile to DACA and so hostile to immigrants, he said he did not favor ending the program. I mean, is it possible that this moment, which is so catastrophic for you and the 800,000 other young adults who are granted some relief, some protection from deportation, is it possible that this could be the moment where enough is happening politically, enough support is generated, that comprehensive immigration reform, a path to legalization, could actually be achieved?
Right now, I think a lot, the focus is on supporting the vulnerable immigrants. I know that the conversations around comprehensive immigration reform have been on the table for a very long time in the Congress. And, we've seen them on gridlock. So, there's a lot of different senses about what is possible and what is not on the legislative front. But right now, our message and focus is clear, and that is that we need to protect the vulnerable immigrants, including the young adults who are affected by the change of policy today. And whatever it takes, we are going to demand that Congress do the right thing by passing, a permanent legislative solution to protect these young adults.
Yeah, and I think Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump were going against the tide of majority sentiment in the United States when they did this, when they rescinded this. We have less than 1 minute, just about 50 seconds left, Angie Kim. What does it mean in practical terms to protect the most vulnerable? Go ahead.
You know, right now, the most important thing is for the communities to come together and support and do everything that they can. You know, we're talking about educators, nurses, lawyers, doctors. We are going to rely on the community to protect, our own community. And yes, we will, be pushing for a legislative solution. But right now, we need a lot of support for, all our immigrant families out there and be the allies that we need at the moment.
Yeah, because a lot of families, moms, dads, sisters, brothers, grandparents, all of them can be and are being ripped apart every day as the immigration deportation machine is in full throttle. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined by Angie Kim, community organizer with the Minquan Center for Community Action. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to be right back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. On a visit to Houston over the weekend, Donald Trump said the Hurricane Harvey relief operation was, quote, working out well. We're going to talk about that, how well it's working out. We are joined from North Houston, Texas, by Colonel Ann Wright. She is a retired U.S. Army colonel and a State Department official who resigned in protest of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Welcome back, Ann.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be with you.
Ann Wright, you've been in Texas. You're helping a friend and others clean up and salvage things. You've been there for 3 or 4 days, I think. I want to ask you your impressions, your human firsthand impressions. But before we do that, I want to play a short audio clip for the audience. It's Donald Trump talking about how everyone is really happy in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. He was speaking to a shelter where people who had lost their homes were temporarily sheltered, and maybe temporary is going to be for a long time. Let's listen to the president.
We're just happy. We saw a lot of happiness. It's been really nice. It's been a wonderful thing. It's as tough as this was, it's been a wonderful thing. I think even for the country to watch and for the world to watch. It's been beautiful. Have a good time, everybody. I'm going to be doing a little help over here. Say? They're really happy with what's going on. It's been something, it's been very well received. Even by you guys, it's been well received.
Ann Wright, that's the President of the United States. Go ahead.
Well, it is pretty crazy. I mean, they're happy to be alive, that's for darn sure, with all of the huge amount of water that came in. And if it hadn't been for citizens around the Houston area and where these floods hit, if those people had not come out to help save their neighbors, we would have had a massive amount of death. And when you look at the destruction, that the people that are in the shelters, many of them have not even been able to get back to their homes to even see what the damage is. Some of them have. In fact, we were down in Dickinson, which is in South Houston, where the entire suburb, I mean, there must be probably 5,000 homes. It's just endless. Every single roadway off the main roads is nothing but houses where everything has been brought out of them. They're on the curb. People have had to go in, knocking out all the sheetrock to try to keep the mold and mildew from forming. It looks like a tornado, of course, but without the houses being totally blown to smithereens. The houses are standing, but everything in it has been taken out. And just to see the, you know, the lives of people that are now standing on the curb, their physical possessions are on the curb, and they are happy to be alive, that's for sure, but they went through hell to get there. Some of the people that we were helping, the water rose in some areas so quickly that they had gone to bed, and then all of a sudden they just started feeling things kind of rumbling and got out, and the water was so deep that they knew they had to escape then. And the folks that we were helping, it was about 11:30 at night, and they got their dog and their, that's about it, started walking, and they had to walk a mile to get to Highway 45, the main thoroughfare that fortunately was, that part of it was still above water. And somebody met them there, and they didn't see their home for the next 3 days, and then they went back in by boat to see it, and it was still in 4 feet of water. And just as miraculous, I mean, just as unbelievably, the water rose so fast, it left so fast. They were able the next day to go into their house, and that's when we started helping them to carry out all of this water-soaked. Every single thing in their house had to come out and is now on the curb.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's not, I mean, Donald Trump just sounds enthusiastic. It's like it's a great photo op for him. In no empathy, actually, for the people. I mean, no, for the people who have died, people who have lost everything, people who are losing their jobs. And of course, the way the American economic system functions, unless people bought flood protection, if they just had home insurance, they're not going to be compensated, or certainly not adequately. Big businesses will be compensated quickly. And the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, said Saturday that 13 Superfund sites have been flooded or could be facing damage as a result of Hurricane Harvey. Talk about what the Superfund sites are and what does it mean that they've been flooded like this?
Okay. Yeah, well, the Superfunds are these sites that have been designated by EPA as places where noxious, poisonous chemicals from either the oil industry or other chemical companies that have just been dumped and have been discovered leaching into water supplies, and some of them are near schools. So there's a great problem for humans to be around them. Well, these sites have not been remediated. They have not been dug up. They've not been, nothing's been done to really stop all of the leaching that's being done. And these things are were flooded over. So all of this mess, joined with the huge amount of flood water that was coming down through Houston, and so the people that were walking around in the floodwaters trying to save people, all of these folks have just been exposed to horrific amount of chemicals and dirt and grime. They're telling everyone to be very, very watchful of any sort of cuts that they got, and to watch out for infections, because the mess that they've been exposed to is horrific. And even when we were pulling out all of the drywall in the homes that we were working on, you know, you had to wear masks, you had to wear gloves, you had to have boots on because of the, everything was wet. And all of this moisture was just a filthy, filthy contaminated mess.
We're talking to Colonel Ann Wright. She was a longtime veteran of the U.S. military, an official in the State Department. She resigned from the State Department in protest over George W. Bush's invasion, shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003. Ann Wright is now in Texas helping people, and it really is a people's effort. I mean, even though we have FEMA and we have the government, I was reading an article, I think it was in The Nation magazine, the headline was, "When a natural disaster occurs, everyone becomes a socialist," meaning people really become social. They stand with their neighbors. They stand with their sisters and brothers. Instead of it being like dog eat dog, people really do come together. And right, we have about 3 minutes left. You're in Houston. You've been there. Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm leaving in just a few minutes, hopping in a truck with some friends to head down to the Gulf Coast to visit with our folks down there that have been the fishing industry kind of decimated, with fishing boats being torn up by the hurricane as it hit, and the environmental disasters of all of this flood water coming into the Gulf. It's really quite a huge disaster for this part of our country. But as you mentioned, people did come together. I haven't seen the Red Cross. I haven't seen the Salvation Army. I haven't seen any of the FEMA. However, you see on the streets, yesterday when we were working, we had a young group of kids that came through from a church. We had some football players that were there from a local football team. We had a guy that just dropped off a 5-gallon drum of just miscellaneous stuff. We had a guy that came by with pizzas. So there are everybody's hanging together on this, and they're not waiting for the government to do anything. It's the people that are doing the rescuing, the people that are keeping people alive, and we ought to be proud of that, people coming together as they should.
Right now there's a Category 5 hurricane that's developed in the Caribbean. It's going to hit Cuba. It's going to hit Puerto Rico. It's expected to hit Florida in a few days. We have these extreme weather events. Of course, hurricanes, you know, there is a hurricane season. It begins in August. It goes to about the end of October or so. But they're getting worse. They're getting worse because of global warming, because the waters are getting warmer. When you think back, Ann, right in our last minute and a half or so, big picture, what does this country, what do all countries need to do? Obviously, people, as you're saying, on the ground, they're working together. But government and policy will make a big impact on all things, on recovery, but also on the big picture issue of global warming.
Indeed, and what we as Americans have to do is to keep putting pressure on our Congress and our president. It's for our president to be saying no to global warming and pulling out of environmental treaties that we have, the Paris Accords and things like that, is just horrendous. And the rest of the world is looking at us like you stupid things. Maybe, you know, you're getting the brunt of some of these extreme weather conditions. You know, 12 years ago, we were in New Orleans right after Camp Casey happened in Texas. We took all of our supplies to New Orleans for that horrific hurricane there. And here it is 12 years later, more extreme weather events that are hitting us. We've got to recognize that there is a change in our weather conditions that we human beings are responsible for.
Final question. The Guardian newspaper from the UK reported also that people are being evicted by landlords from their homes for not paying their rent right now in Houston. I wonder what your view is in terms of government intervention. Should there be a moratorium on evictions under circumstances such as these?
Well, certainly so. That's just horrific that landlords are doing that. And we certainly hope that people's organizations here in Houston will rally together and prevent those evictions from taking place. Just outrageous what they're doing.
Okay, and just last quick question. Trump has asked Congress to appropriate $7.85 billion for federal resources for responding and initial recovery efforts related to Hurricane Harvey. At the same time, you had Republicans in Congress trying to reduce funding both for the flood insurance program and for some of these other national programs. I mean, you're in Texas. That's a state that voted for Donald Trump. What will the impact be, if any, politically? About 30 seconds.
Well, one would hope the impact is going to be that people are going to vote out of office these Congress people that have no sympathy at all for those that are the most deeply affected, those who have minimal wage jobs, that are some of them are without jobs right now, and all of them are homeless. So let's hope that there's a shakeup in our government for those who don't want to help people. Get them out and get some people in there that will help people.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined by Colonel Ann Wright. She's talking to us from Houston, Texas. She's there, part of the relief effort. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Syrian government forces have breached a 3-year-long siege of the city of Deir al-Zor giving them a major strategic victory as the territory held by the so-called Islamic State continues to erode. We are joined from London by Christopher Davidson. He is a professor at the University of Durham and the author of Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East. We're also joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Welcome back, Christopher and Masoud.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining. Before we get started, I want to play a short clip. It's from RT. It's the Russian Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, speaking about the importance of this battle at Deir al-Zor. Let's listen to him, listen to this clip, and then I want to get your reaction.
Today, there are strategic locations such as Deir ez-Zor, which I would call a priority. Besieged forces have been courageously defending it for years now, while food, medicine, and weapons are airdropped to them. The liberation of the city would be a turning point in the defeat of ISIL.
Christopher Davidson, is this a turning point?
Yes, in many ways. This was a pocket of territory held by the Syrian government for the past few years. In fact, one of the greatest and most bloodiest sieges of the past few years. So to really be able to break this siege, to lift it, means that the Syrian government can genuinely claim to be projecting power into the eastern part of Syria, not just this western and the main urban centers of the western part of the country.
And Masoud, Deir ez-Zor is located to the east and to the south of Raqqa, the so-called caliphate, the capital of the caliphate of ISIS, along the Euphrates River. You have American-supported SDF forces, the Kurdish forces, and some smaller contingents of Arab fighters with them, sort of mounting an offensive from another part of Syria towards Raqqa. What happens next? Is this sort of a race for Raqqa from two different, perhaps, forces that say they have a common enemy but actually have different agendas?
Well, yes, there is definitely a different agenda here. But the fact of the matter is that this is not an isolated sort of victory. We have seen the Syrian forces with the help of Russians and Hezbollah have achieved quite a lot in this area and indeed in bordering with Lebanon. So this is ongoing sort of a process. And the fact of the matter is that this sort of turning point happened before Americans really got involved in Syria in the way that they have been in the recent months. And I think, the initiative really was with the Syrians and the Russians and the Hezbollah. And the fact is that I think sort of the change of heart to some extent by Americans is because of the victories that Syrians have managed to achieve with their support of their allies. And I don't see any reason that this will not continue. And really, I think in many ways, all observers see that this is sort of beginning of the end of ISIS and beginning of sort of Syria being able to sort of put their territory under their own control and move forward.
Yeah, that's the voice of Masoud Shajarey. We're speaking with him and also Professor Christopher Davidson from London about the battle in Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day at 105.5 FM, Monday through Friday, 5 to 6 p.m. Christopher Davidson, Masoud is making the point that the Syrian Arab army, and with the support of its Russian allies and the support of Hezbollah and Iranian militias, has really turned the tide, and that the American entrance or re-entrance into Syria militarily is an attempt by the U.S. government to have some sort of relevance, but perhaps some sort of say in the outcome of a post-ISIS, post-war Syria. Do you see it the same way?
Well, in many ways, yes. I think if we were to take this to the autumn, the fall of 2016, the American plan was still very much one that the Syrian government could be defeated by the various collection of rebels, including jihadist groups backed either by the United States or by its Gulf monarchy allies. Then, of course, as we got to the end of 2016, we saw that sort of plan A start to fail. So the next best plan, in many ways, the plan B,
becomes that the United States needs to then defeat ISIS quickly in the pockets of territory it holds, so that the United States and its allies on the ground can at least claim something of this Syria, a sort of scramble for territory, a scramble for geographical assets, if you were. If we're to look at the U.S. coalition's position before the end of 2016, we see remarkably little being done to defeat the Islamic State in its territory. For example, the city we're talking about, Deir ez-Zor, we had the U.S. coalition strike not once but twice the Syrian government forces during critical battles when they were trying to push back the Islamic State. Today we learn that Russian cruise missiles hit a heavily fortified building in ISIS-held territory outside Deir ez-Zor. Why was that building not hit by U.S. coalition forces for the past 3 years? They're very big questions that people need to be asking about the U.S. coalition and the extent of its genuine airstrikes against the Islamic State over the past few years.
So, but what are you suggesting, real quick? What do you mean by that? In other words, you're suggesting, or it seems to me, you're implying that the U.S. wasn't really earnestly trying to defeat ISIS. In other words, still perhaps seeing ISIS as somehow something for leverage within Syria?
Yeah, ISIS in many ways was a sort of placeholder. ISIS was the force that could potentially carve out a conservative Sunni Islamic regime in the eastern part of Syria and the western part of Iraq. Nobody likes them, but they had the potential to create a block in this chain of power from Tehran through Baghdad across to Damascus and Beirut, which could conceivably be a chain of power allied to Iran. And in many ways, the Islamic State, I believe, for the past few years, was largely tolerated as a result of that. The extent of airstrikes, for example, over the past 3 years, since September 2014, when the U.S. coalition began, have been remarkably little on Islamic State-held territory. Nothing, for example, compared to the Western coalition strikes on Saddam's Iraq, on the Taliban in Afghanistan, and even on the Serbian regime in the 1990s.
Okay, let me ask Masoud, what's your opinion on all that?
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, even if we go beyond that, before Russia actually got involved in a major way, the sort of sale of oil and the way that we all seen the footage and photographs of sort of the trail of these tankers, you know, sort of fueling and then going to Turkey. And
meaning tankers that were operated by ISIS, oil tankers.
Yeah, well, operated by ISIS and tolerated by everyone, by Americans. You know, they were never bombed. They were allowed to enter Turkey and sell their oil and therefore sort of strengthening ISIS. And this wasn't something which was done sort of underground. It was done very openly, very publicly. And, you know, all those footage that we used to see of convoys, huge convoys of cars, all same model, same color, latest model, being used by ISIS. I mean, this is outrageous to actually say that that sort of equipment could get in to sort of Syria or Iraq. These vehicles have, you know, sort of sat-navs that could be identified anywhere in the world. And suddenly they all end up in the hand of ISIS, almost the fleet sort of ordered. And then, you know, they operate going anywhere in the large numbers without being bombed, without being affected. I mean, that actually sort of strengthened what professor was saying, that, you know, really they were being tolerated.
Masoud, let me give Christopher Davidson the last word here. We have just a little bit less than 1 minute. Professor Davidson, what comes next? Of course, the United States is there, but how do you see it playing out in the next months, perhaps the next year?
Yeah, I think as far as the United States is concerned, the bit of Syria they're hoping to hold on to is the bit of in the north and the bit in the northeast with their Kurdish allies on the ground and various other groups. I think as far as they're concerned, they will try and get their allies to hold on to the territory around the airbase they have constructed, the U.S. airbase, the small base they've constructed in northeastern Syria, and hopefully even the area around Raqqa itself, leaving really the rest of the country to the Syrian government, backed by Iran and Russia, of course, and perhaps this pocket of al-Qaeda territory up in Idlib, up in the north, up in the northwest. I think as far as the United States is concerned, it's washing its hands of all parts of Syria apart from this strategically useful northeast.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by Professor Christopher Davidson. He's a professor at the University of Durham and the author of Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East. We've also been joined from London by Masoud Shajarey, the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. While the U.S. government mulls sending lethal weapons to Ukraine's government, Russia is proposing a peacekeeping operation in the eastern part of the country to defuse simmering tensions. We are joined from New York City by Ben Norton. Ben is a journalist with Alternet's The Gray Zone Project. Welcome back, Ben.
Always glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. I want to talk about Ukraine and this new proposal that's been made by the Russian president. Well, it's been proposed or announced at a press conference following the BRICS meeting. But before we do that, I want to play a short audio clip. It's the U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis speaking alongside Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko on August 24th, emphasizing the extensive assistance the U.S. provides to Ukraine.
For example, we've just approved, just very recently, the last couple of weeks, another $175 million worth of equipment, including some specialized equipment that can be used to help defend the country, bringing to a total of nearly $750 million in the last several years. So we are in this very, very much in support of you. I would also point out that on the defensive lethal weapons, we are actively reviewing it.
So what that means for the audience, Ben Norton, the fact that James Mattis says we're actively reviewing sending weapons, President Obama during, well, after the 2014 change in government following the coup d'etat, he decided against sending $3 billion in so-called defensive arms and equipment to Ukraine, which would have included anti-armor missiles, reconnaissance drones, armored Humvees, and radars that can determine the location of enemy rocket and artillery fire. I'm reading from the New York Times, talking about the irony that Obama sort of put the brakes on, and here you have the Trump administration, which purportedly was going to improve relations with Russia, now actively considering sending weapons to Ukraine, which will be perceived by Russia as an escalation. And at the same time, you have Putin now saying, let's bring peacekeepers to the to eastern and southern part of Ukraine. What's your take on all of this?
Well, I think it really underscores just what you said, the intense hypocrisy of the Trump administration, and also how behind a lot of this, you know, fear-mongering and paranoia about Russia and Washington is smoke and mirrors. Trump, like you said, kind of flirted with the notion of some kind of rapprochement. And when he campaigned, you know, he claimed that he would withdraw from wars and focus less on military might. But of course, we've seen that now that Trump's in office, he's expanding wars in places like Afghanistan, where he's sending thousands of more troops. And in Ukraine, Trump is actively considering a proposal to send more and more arms, as you just said, to the Ukrainian government. And again, so we understand the context here, the Ukrainian government is a very right-wing government, elements of which are fascist. The head of the parliament, the Rada, Andriy Parobi, is a fascist who founded a neo-Nazi-style white supremacist party. So when we look at the Trump administration's response, I mean, you can, of course, underscore the hypocrisy, which is very important, but also the fact that there is no goal in the future that will in any way reduce tensions. I mean, this is not just true for Ukraine, it's also true for Afghanistan. What is the goal of sending more and more weapons to Ukraine? How is that going to end out? What is the war going to actually end, or is it going to continue? And of course, the answer is it's going to continue. What is the goal of sending thousands more troops to Afghanistan? I mean, all of these are intimately linked. And what they also highlight is the fact that Trump has given carte blanche to the Pentagon, to people like Mad Dog Mattis, these extremely belligerent generals, to essentially do whatever they want. And in July, it was the Pentagon that offered the plan to send advanced weaponry, including anti-tank missiles, to Ukraine. So again, we see echoes of the war in Syria. We see echoes of the now 16-year war in Afghanistan. And what we should be talking about is how can the war in Ukraine come to a peaceful end rather than how can we continue escalating it?
Well, let me jump in and ask you about that then. So obviously the people in eastern and some parts of southern Ukraine, informally, well, not formally Crimea. Crimea is Crimea, but formerly part of Ukraine now after a referendum affiliating with Russia, which historically Crimea was part of Russia. But obviously, the people who living in that part of Ukraine look to Russia. They speak Russian. They're culturally connected to Russia. There's been a lot of argument by people demanding more money for the military in the U.S. Congress that Russia has designs on eastern Ukraine. In other words, they say, well, it next Crimea, next will be the eastern part of Ukraine. Thus, we must have NATO war exercises. Thus, we must build up the military sort of positioning of U.S. and NATO forces in that region to protect eastern Ukraine. It seems to me on its face that Vladimir Putin's announcement would sort of take away a propaganda point that those people are making. If he's saying, let's bring in the UN, a UN mission that would include peacekeepers and would provide security for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, so that they would have monitors in Ukraine, that would indicate that Russia, in fact, doesn't have any plans for a military engagement there. Do you think, one, the U.S. will favor such an intervention? Will the Poroshenko government favor it? What's your estimate on that? We have about a little bit less than 5 minutes.
No, I mean, it's, of course, hard to speculate, but we can look at historical examples and learn from those. In 2012, in a conflict that's closely related, Russia proposed that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad step down and there be a kind of democratic process by which the future of the Syrian government be decided. Well, the U.S. government was not interested in this offer at all. The U.S. wanted to pursue violent regime change as it did in Libya the year before, and it rejected Russia's offer for a peaceful diplomatic settlement. So I think, you know, there are many other instances historically, and we can draw the conclusion that the U.S. is not really interested in these kind of political diplomatic mechanisms. The U.S. is interested in winning the war militarily and bleeding its enemy. And as I said, the Ukrainian government under Poroshenko, who is a right-wing billionaire, is certainly not, shy when it comes to these kinds of intense militarizations, intense further escalation of the conflict.
We're speaking with Ben Norton. He is a journalist with the Alternet's The Gray Zone Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM. In our last few minutes, Ben Norton, I want to ask you about what this might mean, this offer by Russia, and also what the response might be from the United States with more weapons to Ukraine from U.S. allies, including NATO allies. Germany's foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, said he found Putin's announcement surprising, but said he was, quote, very glad. The Russian president said today he will continue to negotiate about demands that were rejected in the past by Russia. More importantly, this offer of a UN mission in eastern Ukraine shows that Russia has effected a change in its policies that we should not gamble away. I mean, Germany obviously wants to have a different outcome. They don't want weapons. They don't want a greater confrontation. What might this mean for U.S.-German relations? Because, of course, Ukraine's in their neighborhood.
Absolutely. And when it comes to these issues, Germany has always played a much more active role. I think what's very clear that the German government has expressed complete disapproval for Donald Trump. You know, Angela Merkel infamously said just several months ago that now that it's going to pursue a path independent of the U.S. But when we're looking at the conflict in Ukraine, I think another important thing about the German foreign minister Gabriel's comment was that he also used the word détente. He said we need to find new ways of détente in the region. And of course, again, this is a very significant thing to underscore, the fact that there have been peace talks going on. I mean, it's been called the Normandy Front between Germany and Russia and also Ukraine and France. And those talks have not really gone too far thus far. But I think it's important to stress this element. And the fact that both Germany and Russia are interested in this kind of diplomatic solution, I think, is a very positive sign. But unfortunately, of course, at the other end, we have the Trump administration, which is further militarizing the conflict. And again, there is no end goal in mind other than continued death and destruction. And I think something like the Normandy format talks are a really positive way forward, and those should be encouraged.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned détente, because, of course, Nixon and Kissinger inaugurated a policy of détente to lessen the tensions in the Cold War with the USSR. After Nixon was removed, he resigned rather than be impeached. Détente became verboten, to use a German word. In other words, outside the political lexicon, identified it somehow too peaceful, too soft on the Soviet Union. And then we had a new major arms race. Ben Norton, with 30 seconds left, I mean, where is it going? I mean, is there any hope that there actually could be a shift in U.S. policy, or do you see just more of the same? 30 seconds.
I don't think so, unfortunately. And if there is, it's certainly not going to come from the right. We see already that Donald Trump will say one thing and do another. He said during his campaign he might pursue a kind of anti-interventionist approach, and he's escalating numerous wars, and he has put the generals in charge. It's not just that the generals have taken over. He has put them into power. It was his choice to do that. So I think that in the next 3 years, we're going to see a further escalation of wars, not just in Russia, or not just in Ukraine, against Russia, but also even potentially in parts of Latin America and the Middle East and even in the Korean Peninsula. And I think it's very important to resist already what the Trump administration is doing. This is the most important part of the anti-Trump resistance, is pushing back against his hyper-militarist policies.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ben Norton. We've been talking to Ben Norton. He's a journalist with Alternet's The Gray Zone Project. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. metro area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, at 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.